Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, our panel of experts explore China's increasing involvement in brokering deals in the Middle East, Russia and China's shared and separate agendas, and the potential for a new global power structure. Recorded live at the 2023 Bradford Literature Festival, join us for a conversation on the developing relationships between Russia and China and the challenge that poses to the traditional dominance of the West in global politics and economics.
I'm Paul Rogers, more or less local to Bradford, actually Huddersfield, but that's near enough. And welcome to the session this morning. As you probably know, many of you who know the festival quite well will know that the leading light virtually from the beginning, in fact from the beginning in a way, is Sima Aslam. And essentially she has a unique gift for predicting events. So when she mentioned to me a few months ago, asked if I'd chair a panel on essentially Russia, China and the New World Order, I don't think even she really knew that there was going to be news that morning. And some of us who've been around doing lecturing over the last 30 years or so, remember I was teaching at a defence college the day before the Berlin Wall started to come down. And if it had been the day after, I would have had to rewrite part of the lectures. But we've got great panellists here. Now, our panellists, on my immediate right is Ben Bland, head of the Asia-Pacific Centre at Chatham House, you know, one of the world's leading think tanks. Ben previously was at the Lowy Centre in Australia, although he is British. In fact, he's a Londoner like me, but you don't mention that in Yorkshire. My wife's Yorkshire. And he's got two notable books, one relating to Indonesia, another relating to Hong Kong. Before he went to the Lowy Institute, though, he was actually Financial Times correspondent covering China. So an incredibly good person to be speaking today. I think this is his first time to the festival and might even be one of the first times to Bradford, so it's a real welcome to that. Trouble is, once you come here, you don't leave, so watch it. Daria next is, Daria Mattingly is actually from Kyiv originally, so welcome here. She is a lecturer in European history at Chichester University. She did a PhD at Cambridge, was then a Leverhulme Early Career Fellow, and also has a part-time teaching connection with Cambridge still. And she's actually working on a book looking mainly at the Stalin period, an aspect of that. And I've told her that if that was to be published a little before next year's festival, I'd make damn sure that she got an invitation to speak about it. We're going to go in the sort of reverse order, Daria and Ben, and then throw it open to discussion. I've asked them to speak for a maximum of 10 minutes each, but they may well be shorter than that. But I'll give them a warning when you're coming up to about 9 minutes. So that's the plan for this morning. Do you like to start off? We're going to keep it informal. I mean, if people want to stand, they can, but they don't have to. Daria, would you like to come in then?
It's a pleasure to be here. It's a real honor. And I would like, I will touch upon some of the comments that Paul made. But first, I would like to start my contribution to the discussion with the quote from Xi Jinping, his concluding remarks at the meeting with Putin earlier this year in Moscow, when he said, quote, "Right now, we are seeing a change, the kinds of changes," he said, "we haven't seen in 100 years, and we are driving this change together." And in my contribution, I'd like to address three points. The changes that Xi Jinping mentioned, the actors, because he referred to himself and Putin, we are the drivers of these changes, and also the time frame when he said hundreds of years. And I would like to go in that time frame, was the first point, beyond the Cold War, and turn to the history of Ukraine, which many experts on Russia seem to be overlooking, and hence the current Russia-Ukrainian war came as a surprise more than a year and a half ago, with many predicting the war in Ukraine would last days, if not weeks or months. And yet we have a year and a half. So we have to add Ukraine to those actors. So when Xi Jinping mentioned about hundreds of years, I would start the current war in Ukraine not in 2022, not in 2014, but I would go as far back as 200 years ago when modern state of Russia was coming into being. And as many imperial states, you have to subjugate your neighbors. and as an empire, you have to control your colonies. And left bank Ukraine, which is now northeast of Ukraine, became one such victim to this Russian expansion into the West. And that's history of Ukraine. 1654 Union Treaty between Russia and Hetmanate Ukraine. And after that, we have series of wars between Ukraine and Russia in 1708, 1709, and we have massacres, the likes of Bucha, taking place in Ukraine. But that is not taught as part of Russian history. And Ukrainian history is not taught in Ukrainian in British universities. And when you have to compare that with anything in British history, I would compare that to the attempts of Great Britain to control Ireland. As far as 100 years ago, we have a war in Ireland between Great Britain and Ireland. And then within different factions, when brothers turned on brothers following the war with Great Britain as well. So we have different interpretations. And we have different interpretations of the relations between Russia and Ukraine. In Russian history, it seems Russian Empire was a benevolent empire. Everybody joined happily in Siberia, in Central Asia, and Ukraine was part of this Kievan Rus myth. But so did in British Empire. Irish were in the hierarchy, but below English, and so were in Ukrainians in Russian Empire. And as Russia expanded to the West, there were a series of wars. In recent history of Ukraine, it's man-made famine 1932-33, known as the Holodomor, in which 4 million Ukrainians perished. But you're not taught about that in Russian history as well. It's just a collateral cost, collateral damage of collectivization in Soviet history. But whether it's Tsarist Empire or Russian Empire, or Soviet Empire, we always see Ukraine as a colony. And when a colony asserts itself, like it did in the 19th century through a national movement, you have the empire claiming Ukraine does not exist. And this is exactly the framing Putin mentions in his speeches, saying that Ukraine does not exist. They are Russians. They are part of Russians. They are influenced by the West, by NATO. Even though these series of wars between Ukraine and Russia preceded NATO by centuries or years, since 1654, 17th century, 18th century, destruction of Hetmanate state in Ukraine. Then you have October Revolution, and Ukrainians again do not support imperial project. They, in the elections to the Constituent Assembly after October Revolution, they vote overwhelmingly for national parties, Ukrainian national parties. They don't vote for Bolsheviks. They don't vote for Russian national parties. They vote to be something else. They want to be Ukraine. 1919 was a year of great peasant uprising in Ukraine against Bolshevik rule, which Ukrainians lost. They didn't have support of the West. The West didn't know about the existence of Ukraine. And in fact, many in the West until 2014 didn't understand what Ukraine was. When I would mention, even in academic environment, that I was from Ukraine, some people would start talking to me in Russian because it's Russian Empire. Or in non-academic environment, I would say, I'm from Ukraine. Oh, Russia. So 2014 firmly put Ukraine on a map. 2014 and 2022 put Ukraine on the map even further because it asserted agency of Ukraine. It's not about NATO and Russia, but it's also about Ukraine and what Ukraine wants and what Ukrainians want. And in 1919, overwhelmingly, they again vote for independence, including Crimea, including Donbass, including east of Ukraine and west of Ukraine. They all vote for independent Ukraine in 1991. And consecutive elections, we see Ukrainians do not want to be part of this Russian project. But this is not the framing that Putin gives away. And his understanding of the West, NATO, and Ukraine in particular, when he says that, what he says, I'm not going to quote him, but he still operates within this 19th century nationalist understanding of national identity, understanding of Ukraine and imperial state. And that brings back us to actors and China in particular, because we were in discussion with Ben earlier on about what is Chinese take of this war and how Putin handles it. But I will leave it to Ben to explore more about China's perspective. But what is important here is that there is an actor of Ukraine. There is, it's from a historical perspective, in the long durée, the war in Ukraine is long. It's an imperial conquest. But also the events per se, what do they mean? When I mentioned Xi Jinping's quote saying that the events that didn't happen in 100 years, because from Chinese history, we know the 100 years of humiliation, it doesn't have to be 100 years, but 134, something like that. And now we have a century of ascension. But in terms of Ukraine, we have Ukraine now securing the support of the West, understanding of what it is. And this is the changes we indeed did not see in hundreds of years. Indeed, in Russia, 1% of the population controls 48% of national wealth. In China, it is, if I'm not mistaken, 33% of population controls half the population's wealth. I'm sure the gap in the West is not as drastic, but it also is indicative of the problems existing and polarization of the society that you mentioned in America. But I also would like to draw attention not only on the failures of American influence abroad. They've not only been failures. There were Marshall Plan, which I argue would be more success than a failure, in Japan, in Germany. And there is South Korea and American involvement as well. And if we compare North Korea and South Korea, I doubt many people would want to live in North Korea at the moment, especially with the looming famine, which authoritarian regimes, and totalitarian in particular, are very good in inducing and sanctioning man-made famines like Russia did in Ukraine when you want to control the country. So I would draw attention also to positive and not so destructive influence of America. Seductive for sure. But when it comes to Russian interference, it is seductive. It is seductive, especially in the global south, and it has long history also of aid in the developing countries, but also destructive because I don't know any examples of Russian influence being constructive and positive in terms of acquired territories. If we compare Karelia and Finland or its projects anywhere else. And we know from history that Russia does lose in wars. Japanese War, Crimean War, Poles controlled Moscow in early 17th century for a couple of years. Afghanistan as well was not a very successful operation. And following these defeats in wars, Russia faces necessity of reforms. They are not effective to ensure functioning democracy and structural changes long term, but they certainly, these wars are possible to be lost by Russia. And I think what the war in Ukraine is informs us or helps our understanding today, and I'm sure many of you are following the events in Russia at the moment on BBC or Sky News and Al Jazeera, they're covering what is happening right now. But it shows that there will be changes in Russia following this war, and also that Russia is losing its superpower status because current Russia ideology, what it is to be Russian, it's a strong state, special path, and superpower. And we see that it informs China, it informs us of Russia losing all those things because it cannot even control a situation within the country and key actors such as Prigozhin mercenary group Wagner. So it tells China what it can learn to retain its superpower status, what it should do. Likewise, in 1991, when Soviet Union collapsed, China learned a lot from the parade of sovereignties in Eastern Europe, Warsaw Pact countries, and what it should do to prevent similar things happening in China. And right now, China is learning from Russia. It's seen that what Putin is employing in terms of tactics, in terms of warfare, in terms of cyber warfare, is not working as he planned. And obviously, Ukraine is still there standing 1 year and a half later. So I think in this case, I will finish with the quote from Ukrainian national anthem, which is actually mirrors Polish national anthem. And many of those who neighboring countries to Russia, that Polska nie zginęła, and which means Poland hasn't died yet, And Ukraine is as well. Ukraine ще не вмерла means Ukraine hasn't died yet. So it's asserting that you are there, asserting your agency, asserting yourself as a history actor. So Xi Jinping and Putin are not the only actors in that closing remark. And as Ukrainian national anthem says, Ukraine is there to stay and Ukraine will be victorious. Obviously, I have to distanciate myself as an academic here, but as a proud Ukrainian, I would say there is more than Russia and China to our discussion. And on that, I will finish.
Thank you very much indeed, Daria. And Ben, if you would like to follow.
Thanks. Yeah, great to be here. My first time in Bradford. I'm just going to make 3 points. Firstly, about the US-led order and how it's global order and how it's under strain. So I'll just be very brief. Obviously, US dysfunction is one element of that. It's hard to have an effective US-led order when the US has so much domestic turmoil. Although one of my American friends, who's a Democrat, thankfully, likes to joke, America isn't dysfunctional, it's just the Republicans. But obviously, that's part of the problem of political division. But it's not just about the US, it's about our global system, which obviously the US has underpinned over the last 50, 60, 70 years. So the World Trade Organization, which is meant to mediate trade disputes, is not functioning at the moment. The UN, which has been really unbalanced, has basically very low ambition to get involved in different conflicts and problems. Myanmar is a very good example where there's been a very kind of a lack of desire to really push things forward much. And that's partly a reflection of the 200-odd countries that make up the United Nations, that the bureaucracy can't function if our big countries and smaller countries aren't cooperating. The G20, this new group of the world's 20 biggest economies, which had quite an important role during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, was totally absent during the COVID crisis in trying to come up with solutions to equitably share vaccines, personal protective equipment, and the like. And what we have instead, and this was put on the table by Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, is a world in which the pantheons of old, as he called them, the UN, the WTO, the WHO, and the like, are not really working anymore. So countries led by, but not exclusively, the US, are looking to form their own lattice works, as he put it, of kind of informal new institutions. And he said that these sorts of things, which you might include the G7, which is basically sort of rich Western countries, plus Japan and US allies, the Quad, which is this new grouping emerging in Asia with Japan, the US, India, and Australia. You might include AUKUS, this kind of military agreement between the US, Australia, and the UK. That's what's emerging, these kind of minilateral or plurilateral groups. They tend to be ad hoc, unlike the pantheons. They're temporary, they're not permanent, they're issue focused. It's about military equipment, it's about sharing intelligence, it's about, in the case of the G7, collaborating maybe on technology and opposing China in the world. So these institutions are very different from the ones of old, and they're very exclusive, they're not inclusive, so only certain countries can join. So that's kind of the world order under strain. Secondly, I'm going to talk about China's rise and what China sort of wants in the world, in as much as we know. Broadly, I'd say China wants to rebalance the global order, because the US-led order has actually been very good for China, particularly economically. But as John said, China never wrote the rules, and I think as it's has a much bigger position in the world, it's more powerful, it's more confident, it now wants to rebalance things. Quite different, I think, from Russia, which I would see more as a disruptive power. So clearly, China's made massive strides, military terms, economic terms, technological terms, over the last 40 years. Broadly, I would say China wants to, in the first place, make the world safe for the Chinese Communist Party. So very much learning those lessons from 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union, China wants to make sure that the world system does not undermine the position of the CCP in power. That's number one. Secondly, I think China does want to, if it can, push the US out of Asia, particularly on military terms, partly to secure its position. If you look at a map of China, it always seems in our sort of conventional framing that China looms over the whole of Asia. If you flip the map upside down, you see what the Americans call the first island chain of Philippines and Taiwan and Japan, basically hemming in China. closing off its access potentially if there was conflict to the global seas and all the commodities and food that China relies on. So China wants to shift that military balance over time. And I think eventually China wants to start rebalancing the global institutions that we have, the UN and related institutions, so that China has a bigger say, so that its voice is heard more and it gets what it wants, which is what you'd expect for a major rising power. And in terms of what China's doing and how it's trying to do that, I think I would describe its behavior as assertive but cautious, which is slightly contradictory. But I think we're seeing China experiment with some of its own institutions. So to rival, in some senses, the World Bank, they set up something called the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which was meant to be much more fast-moving. It was meant to be much less bureaucratic. It's meant to be much more about build first and ask questions later. But actually what it's ended up being is sort of a World Bank light, so quite similar to the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank or other institutions. It's quite slow moving, it's not that ambitious. Then we have some other things that China's been involved in either setting up or shaping. So we have the BRICS grouping, which includes Brazil, Russia as well, India, China, South Africa, and is now expanding, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as well. I think China is being more experimental in these sorts of organizations about thinking about different types of relations between powers. I guess they would view it as more mutual respect, but I guess more principles of no interference in other countries' domestic affairs. And then China has this whole series of other initiatives, the Belt and Road Initiative, which was mentioned already, very economic focused, and a whole host of new things in the last couple of years. There's a global development initiative, a global security initiative, and a global civilization initiative. And these are all basically on paper. They're speeches, it's rhetoric. It's not clear what they're going to be. But I think one thing that we know they're not yet is they don't require China to take on any responsibility for the world problems. And I think China is trying to advocate a vision of its role as a major global power, slightly different from the US, where they're not going to be the world's policeman that has to take responsibility, you know, in many good ways, as you said, and in many bad ways, as we know, for intervening in other people's problems. All I'd say there, as the last point on China, is that actually entanglement in other people's affairs normally comes by accident. I don't think the US ever sat down and said, we're definitely going to be the global policeman. But as your interests economically, militarily, technologically rise and your footprint across the world gets bigger, you become entangled in problems, whether you like it or not. Just lastly and very briefly, I think US-China relationship and US-China tensions is kind of the defining geopolitical driving force of our era. I don't think that the world will just be determined by what happens in Beijing and Washington. And as Daria said, many other countries have agency here. So we just need to remember there's a whole host of other big rising powers in Asia, obviously, India, Indonesia and others, and elsewhere, Brazil, Nigeria, South Africa. They have their own interests. Sometimes they align with Western powers. Sometimes they align with China. It's really issue by issue. Then we have a whole host of what I would call kind of disruptive powers, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, North Korea. And I don't think what we're going to see is a sort of, I guess, as people in Washington would see, a sort of Manichaean struggle between democracy and autocracy or democracy and authoritarianism, between sort of good and evil. We're going to see a world that's much more complicated than that. And the best evidence is the response of many countries in the developing world to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And whereas I think in the West, we naturally expected people to take a side to see, this is such an obvious violation of the rules-based order, the invasion of another country, a violation of their territorial integrity and sovereignty, that, of course, everyone would condemn Russia at the UN and elsewhere. But actually, many countries just said, it's not really our fight. We're going to stand on the side of this. And I think we're moving to a more multipolar world where it's not just about the US unipolar moment. It's also not about the US and China. It's about this whole host of different countries with their own national interests. And I think some people would view that to be a very positive thing, that a multipolar world is more balanced, it's fairer, more countries have a say. And I think it definitely could go that way. That's the optimistic view. I guess I would lean more towards a pessimistic view, that as we no longer have these pantheons of old, we don't have the referees that we believe in, and we don't have one power standing behind that. I fear we're going to move to a much more contested world with not just no referees, but no agreed rules of the game.
Thanks so much, Ben. Well, we've covered a huge field. But look, thanks very much, everybody, for coming. The panelists think it's been a great session in a very complex subject, and I hope the rest of the festival is as good as this. So thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. The 2024 Bradford Literature Festival starts on the 28th of June and runs for 10 days with a huge programme of events. From comedy to crime, music to memoirs. Head to bradfordlitfest.co.uk to book your tickets now.